Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Pam Winfrey, the author of The Architect Who Changed Our World, a novel based on the life of Andrea Palladio. One of the most influential individuals in the history of architecture. He designed churches and palaces, and he wrote the architectural treatise, The Four Books of Architecture, which even influenced Thomas Jefferson when he designed his home in Monticello. Hey, Pam, thanks for coming.
Hi, how's it going, Roseanne?
It's pretty good, pretty good. We're excited always about a new book to talk about.
I really fell in love with Palladio, I must admit. If you can possibly fall in love with a historical figure, then I did that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, so that means you're going to easily be able to explain to us why he matters in our world today.
Oh, he's like, I don't know, he's beyond the pale in terms of all the things that I felt like he did right. But I think the best experiment is that if you take a little walk down any of your streets in your mind's eye, like say a small town in almost anywhere, and you look at the bank there and you see that sort of triangular shape and then you see the columns, well, that's basically Palladio. So they say he's the most imitated architect that no one's ever heard of. Because he's really influential. And he basically was this young guy who was born in like 1508 and he died in 1580. So it was a long time ago. But he was a miller's son. And he was just this kid who his father probably wanted him to take over the mill. But he was really into stoneworking. And there was a family friend who was an artist and thought he had some talent in that direction. So he got him a job as a stone worker. And then he just never looked back. And the fact that he was not of any class and that he did really well just says a lot, because he just seemed, you know, it's always interesting looking at characters that there's not a lot of detail, but everything I read about him, he just seemed to be like the best dinner companion ever.
So like a well-read, well-schooled on his own, basically.
Yeah. And he, you know, it was the Renaissance. So there's a reason that, you know, he was the way he was. But he also met this guy, Trissino, and Trissino was like a very well-connected, very smart and well-trained, well-schooled guy. I mean, back then, you know, there was no difference between the arts and sciences. There wasn't even a word for science at the time. There was a word for art, but there wasn't for science. And so people, if you were in a well-rounded education, you knew as much about military strategy as you did about arts or physics or any of these things. Back then, they called physics natural philosophy, which just goes to show. But anyway, Trissino was this extraordinary guy, and he recognized the talent in Palladio and basically mentored him, took him under his arm, named him, and took him to Rome, introduced him to Vitruvius, who was one of the early Romans who did a lot of architecture in Rome. And he took him to Rome, and they would do things like meticulously measure all of the ruins in Rome. And then Palladio would extrapolate from the ruins what the buildings actually look like. And you had mentioned the Four Books of Architecture. And I actually got to touch that, which was so crazy. I went for a month in Vicenza and worked on this, because that's where most of his buildings are.
Oh, how brilliant and wonderful. Yeah. What an experience.
It was so crazy. I mean, so unlike the United States, you know, I'd like to see the Four Books of Architecture. This is a very, very, very old book. And they go, okay. And they had me sign some papers, and then they get me up into this little room, and then they put this book in front of me, and I'm able to touch this book, the four books of architecture. It was an extraordinary moment with his little inks on the side and his notes. I mean, it was amazing.
That's fascinating and beautiful to think that it was something he himself touched.
Mm-hmm.
And we're before Gutenberg or after? So how was this book distributed?
That's a very good question. I believe it was hand inked for a really long time. I have, of course, a rendition of it now. You can actually buy it now, but I think it was hand inked, but I'm not exactly sure about that.
That's something I'll have to look into, just to think about the process of how he spread that message. And if it was so fascinating and so desired by other architects around the world,
Yeah, I mean, there for a while, there were artists, Indigo Jones, who was from Europe, and he came down. There were a lot of people that came scooting through Italy and got exposed to these books and then took it back. So you can see a lot of his impact in almost every country. There was even a Russian guy that came. And so you see the influence in some certain kinds of Russian residencies. And as you said, Jefferson, you know, the dome, that was a big part of what Palladio contributed to architecture. But I think even more than individual kinds of structures, it was an attitude. Like, he did this thing where previously everybody had to make their beautiful houses out of stone, and that costs a lot of money. So what he figured out is that you could make it out of brick and then stucco it so it looked like stone. So he had this very egalitarian manner about him. He felt that everybody should be able to afford good architecture. And even though he did these gigantic villas that were definitely for the wealthy, even that middle wealthy, they couldn't have afforded the houses that he built for them, except for the materials that this idea of stuccoing over brick, for example.
Which my neighbor next door just did, which is hilarious.
Very interesting.
It's interesting to think. Two neighbors, actually. One did brick and one did sort of those cement blocks, and both stuccoed over them, and they don't look like what they started out to be, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. He also had he had a kind of a tragic life. He had five kids, and two of his boys died within 2 months of each other. Mm. And his eldest, Leonida, it sounds to me like he was kind of this womanizing, you know, kind of a ne'er-do-well, like very dashing, classic for any kind of romance novel. But there was a woman who was married and brought a knife to the dinner table, and he stabbed the husband to death.
Oh my goodness.
And it seems as though Trissino managed to use his influence to get him off. But he died mysteriously anyway. And then his other son died a month later. So he had some tragedy in his life. And ironically, he never had a house of his own.
Oh, that's terrible, yeah. And hilariously ironic all at the same time. Why was that?
Well, I don't think he could afford it. I think he was just, you know, I don't think architects were paid very well. And although he was at the finest dining tables and he was with all these very wealthy guys, it still didn't really equate to serious money where he could really afford his own building.
Well, I guess it's because he clearly was there because he worked for them. He didn't work with them, and he wasn't among their crowd.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, and you see that today. I mean, it's one of those funny things where you can be at the table, but you're not really at the table.
True. You know?
But he did some amazing things. Like, he was doing churches. His buildings, his villas are really what he's known for. And in Vicenza, he did the Basilica, which is right in the main square. But I would say one of his most insanely cool buildings was this Teatro Olimpico, which is this theater. But it's like, if you just want to just dive into something that is just extraordinary to look at, go look up Teatro Olimpico. It's in Vicenza, and it was built on an old prison area. And he took the original structure that had kind of fallen down, and then he created like sort of an old Roman theater, but it's inside, and it has this insane, like, a scene which is all stone, and then you can go and you can look under an arch and you actually see into the set, and it's all perspective. It's almost as old as the building. They ended up not really having theater. It's kind of a horrible story, this part of it, because they ended up not having theater there for like the next 300 years. But now they have like concerts and things like that. But the statuary is amazing. The experience is amazing. And it's all this perspective where you can look under this arch and you see this amazing set of a Roman street. It's just insanely cool.
It's like looking through a camera at a movie set, essentially.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah. It's forced perspective, you know, especially when you're right in the middle of the theater and you look down at, you can just see all the roads, sort of the single point perspective kind of thing. Yeah. It's really neat.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, so you've mentioned Trissino and you mentioned his father a little bit. Are there other people that influenced him? Kind of what relationships in his life were very important? What about his wife if he has five kids?
Yeah, she is a little bit of a mystery. Her name was Allegradonna, and they don't know much about her except that she brought a bed, a mattress, and a green quilt that had green in it for her dowry.
goodness.
That's all you get.
That's all women get in history. What did you bring to the marriage?
Yes. So, of course, I was thinking, well, what kind of woman would Palladio be attracted to? And so I made her a mathematician.
Oh, wonderful. Of course, because then they could talk about perspective and all the things he was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the hard part. Is it's so often that you have no idea. Women are just disappeared. I was doing this thing on art and science, and most women couldn't be scientists. There were exceptions. They could, you know, they were wealthy men, and they could be exceptions to the rule and actually get a science degree, but most women couldn't. So I was doing this lecture, and it was interesting because I was looking into what were women doing while the men were doing all these great science works. They were painting, and they were doing flowers. They were painting flowers and shells, and, you know, just close observation. But the thing that was really interesting is most of them did not use their real names. So they were like, Mrs. John Doe was doing this painting. So even when you go back to the paintings, you still don't know who actually did it. So, yeah, a little divergent there.
No. That's part of the thing in writing historical fiction. You were trying to create this whole world. And if you don't have any clues as to this woman, then obviously you're telling me that you had to basically create her from scratch.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, the men in his life, really, honestly, most of the men, Tresina was his guy. He did rub shoulders with Leonardo da Vinci, people like that. I mean, when he was in Rome, he was definitely with an amazing group of people. But Tresina was really the guy that did it all for him. And it's interesting to think about what does it take to be an artist now or an architect now? And I would say it's maybe the same, you know, like who's going to represent you? How do you get to the table?
Right. And then who chooses to pay you to create something that you can then use as your showpiece? Someone has to offer you. It's just like being a director. You know, writers can write anything on a page and hope to sell it, but you can't direct anything unless someone gives you a camera and the money to go do it.
I mean, Vicenza is a World Heritage site. And if you ever get the chance to go there, and it's like 45 minutes west and a little bit north of Venice, but you just get to see these truly remarkable buildings. And one of the other things, like he built the Rotunda, which is the one that Jefferson's building is modeled over. But what's cool about it is that, so it has this big dome in the middle, and then it has four kind of separate apartments on that encircle the dome. But all those particular apartments are all designed so that they have equal access to the breezes, to the views. So you have this such an egalitarian and lovely idea of what architecture could do for the people that live there. You know, so it's not, even though of course it's completely hierarchical, in certain ways you feel the man, the humanist man. And that's the other thing was Tresina was known and was called himself a humanist. Uh-huh. And that was, it has kind of a different meaning back then, but I think there was this understanding that the human endeavors, like the arts and the sciences, architecture, math, all these different things, were endeavors of humans, and that humans had rights to those disciplines.
I love that. I love that. That is what an open college system is meant to do, but there are still hindrances.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. There are. And I mean, and he was with wealthy guys his whole career. There was all wealthy people, but there was something about, and it's interesting. Maybe I read too much into these things, but it just feels as though he brought his lower class and his understanding about materials. I got the feeling that he was really, really good with the workmen. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just like he was just offhandedly, you know, saying, do this, do that. But because he had come from those lower classes, and he had experience as a stonemason, so he actually knew materials from a real place.
Correct.
And I think that all, you can feel it in the buildings. The buildings feel, they make you feel good when you're in them.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Now you're making me, I must go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so while you were researching him, and you had this beautiful experience to actually be in his world, what was the most interesting thing? What was your favorite find about him, whether it was a physical thing, whether it was a thing you got to stand in front of and look at, or a fact you encountered about him?
I got the chance to work at the Palladio Museum, which is in Vicenza. And every afternoon, I would play with my kids, and we would sightsee. And then in the afternoon, I would go and sit in the library. And Donatella, I became great friends with her. She was this amazing woman. Mm-hmm. She was very supportive, and it would rain every day about the same time, like at 2 in the afternoon. And he even had designed these spouts that had, they were like birds. So the water would come rushing out of the birds, which is certainly a visual and a sound that I will take for a long time. I hope I remember that. But probably the starkest and strangest thing about him is that he had a certain kind of fame during his lifetime, but nobody is exactly sure how he died.
Really?
Which is a little weird to me. There's theories, there's ideas, but nobody says, oh yeah. And they even have a date for it, which I'm kind of like, I don't know. Cause they don't know where he was when he died. There's no real record of when he died.
And you would think, being known by all those people, it would have been a big uproar. It might have been mentioned in someone's work, something.
Something. Yeah. I mean, the funeral would have been in somebody's church, you know? So I think that's very strange. And I can't quite figure that out, except maybe just chalk it up to antiquities, you know, and that things happen and things are lost forever. So I don't know. Found that to be very strange.
Wow. So you've mentioned the sciences a couple times. So what in your background made you connected to him?
Well, my background is science and art. That's what I do. That's my bread and butter. I have a degree in theater. I have a master's in interdisciplinary arts and an MFA in television screenwriting, which I got from Stevens. Yay. So I'm kind of I've been an amalgamation for a long time, and I've made my career doing science and art and technology and doing curating works about that. So for me, it was a nice wedding of being able to look at aesthetics, but also look at architecture from a math perspective, and just looking at how the four books of architecture are so fun because he actually describes how you do a terrazzo floor. You know, like you can go there and go, oh, this is how you make that. So he was like this kind of has a DIY feel to it as well. So curating is kind of my thing. And now I'm the host for the Leonardo Lasers, which is an international magazine and a panel where I get to talk to artists and scientists all over the world. So it all's coming full circle.
That's wonderful. That's so wonderful. So being that this was a piece of historic fiction, is there a scene that you had to write that you enjoyed writing, something that blended some characters together, or just something you were like, I really love the fact that I came up with that and it exists now in this book?
The one that first comes to mind is he's sitting in a park and he's really young and he watches pigeons courting, and there's two female pigeons and a male pigeon, and he watches which female gets chosen by the male, and then he decides, he goes, you know, I could really use a wife. That was a lot of fun.
But, that's adorable.
I did another one that was really funny where Vitruvius Man is, you know, you think of the Leonardo, the classic Leonardo guy, the Vitruvian Man. And so at one point I have all these wealthy guys trying it out, and they started by having some poor guy standing up and he's got his arms raised and they probably had a lot of wine. And then he starts getting tired and they realize, oh, he can just lie down and we can measure, you know, because it's all about measurement, like how many heads is your torso and all these things. So because it's all about the human body and how the human body relates to architecture is a very big part. It's like the golden mean and all these other ideas about what is aesthetically pleasing. But that was a lot of fun, too. So
how fun. And to use your past ideas into what would be imagining they would be.
Yeah, I'll give you one more just because I had such fun with this. When he was in Venice, there was this anti-Semitic problem as usual. And there was one of the people that he knew really was really pushing for the Venice Senate to be able to have a man who was Jewish and start participating in that. And there was this big kerfuffle. And I ran across this woman who was Jewish and they said that she had a voice that was like an emerald. It was just this incredibly beautiful voice. And so I was able to do that scene and to show that racism at the time where people suddenly realized who she was and they started, you know, like drifting off and being really rude to her and things like that. And to be able to show those kind of biases was also really rewarding.
Well, that's wonderful, and leads me right into one of the things I like to ask writers about is, what kind of themes did you find running through his life, or did you paste onto his life in order to give it some spine and some connection?
It really was about class. It was about class. And how he managed against all odds, because I don't think it was very common for artisans of his reputation in the end to come from a lower class. He had no one to help him. Yeah. And his dad died early. His mom died really early when he was 7 or 9 or something like that. And I felt like he somehow, through, I don't know whether it was charm or wit or talent, it was probably a whole bunch of different qualities that he had, but somehow he was welcomed in. And I think often about, you know, like the fact, well, first of all, he was Italian, he was white, he was a man. Right. So he had some pretty good things going for himself, right? Because if he wasn't any of those things, he probably wouldn't have been at the table.
He'd be the wife who had only brought the quilt, right?
Yes, he'd be the wife that brought the quilt. So a lot of that stuff was always on my mind, but it was also interesting to just think about how he must have been in order to even be at the table, even though he had that privilege. So
yeah. That makes sense. It makes sense. Wonderful. That always leads me to my favorite last question, which is always to ask, who were your mentors?
You know, it's funny you should ask. There's a guy, he was my choir director in high school. His name is Chuck Ashford. And I have been in contact with him, and he got back. He talked to me about this book, and he really loves the book. And I was telling him just today, I said, I have to write you this email. I've been wanting to write this email to you for a long time. Because he was one of these guys that had, you know, he was demanding, and this is in high school, really demanding. He would do anything to get these really stellar, beautiful performances out of these choirs. And he did. And it must have taken, when I think about it, it must have taken so much out of him, because he was always there. You know, he would do anything to get those performances. And I mean, you know, like anything within reason, but like expecting the best. And he is certainly one of my mentors.
That's a beautiful, expecting the best out of people. And then they try to give it to you, and they actually push themselves farther than even they knew they could go.
Absolutely. Oh, Chuck was definitely like that.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you. This has been wonderful.
Yes, it's always a joy to talk to you, Roseanne. I hope things stay well with you, and eventually we could even meet in person, and maybe we could even hug.
There you go. That would be a beautiful thing. In the meantime, I shall make sure that all my friends know about the book, and we shall make sure other people know that they can learn a lot from Palladio's life.
Thank you so much. It's been good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.